Enjoy the convenience of 7 days a week banking and extended hours with Cube from First Arkansas Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Rich Eisen Show.
I love a journeyman quarterback. They always got a nice tan. Like Steve DeBerg. Steve DeBerg. He was the Magnum P.I. He was the Magnum P.I. of the NFL. He played like 38 seasons.
Yeah, he was pristine.
But the thing was, for 38 whatever seasons, probably like 20 seasons, he was always ready to go.
Right. The Rich Eisen Show. Weekdays from noon to 3 Eastern on ESPN Radio, ESPN Plus, and on Disney Plus. Evan, Canty, and Michelle are unsportsmanlike.
Rocky IV is amazing. The scene where he's in the car driving after Apollo Creed dies, and he's so upset, obviously. Oh, yeah.
Spoiler alert.
I need to put a spoiler alert on that.
I've never seen it.
2025.
I never saw it.
Michael B. Jordan did 3 movies as his son living after the dad died.
Guess I don't need to watch it now.
The movie's 40 years old, Smoltz.
For some of us, it's brand new.
Unsportsmanlike. Weekday morning starting at 6 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN2. The Rich Eisen Show.
Frank Caliendo, I'd like to ask Adam Schefter, what is the meaning of Christmas?
Well, according to my sources, at this particular time, it appears that Christmas is about giving. It is the giving season. And according to my sources, deck the halls with boughs of holly. According to my sources, la la la.
The Rich Eisen Show, from noon to 3 Eastern on ESPN Radio, ESPN Plus, and on Disney Plus.
The Yankees were in contention for the division title against the favored Toronto Blue Jays. In a conversation I had with an editor, we were talking about an article that I could write in which I would lay out some examples of ways the Yankees could be boosted by their performance on the field and ways that they can be buried. And when I talked about what could boost them, the first place that I turned was the starting rotation. And I wrote about Jim Abbott and Melito Perez, and they had both struggled to that point. The second place Yankees could be boosted or buried by certain developments as they attempt to slice the current 2-game gap. Ways to boost the Yankees' chances. Significant contributions from Melito Perez and Jim Abbott. The excuses are growing old. Solid starts and games that could have or should have been won by these two underachievers are no longer important. Only victories are. I called them underachievers because in my mind, they had not reached expectations to that point. I imagine that no one had ever called Jim Abbott an underachiever in his life.
I was hurt by it. And then I went one and did one of the things I regret most of my career. I went to the stadium when we got back, and I confronted Jack, and I used the excuse. I used the excuse, and I said, "How can you call me an underachiever?"
He held up the newspaper. His face was red. He was hot. He was angry. And I said to him, "You've always told me that you wanted to be treated like every other major league pitcher. You didn't want to be treated as someone who was the left-handed pitcher who was born without a right hand. I wrote that you had underachieved because the Yankees had expected more from you."
Hit me, you know. I went back and apologized to him, and I said, "You're right, Jack. I'm sorry." you're exactly right. And in that moment, I was getting exactly what I wanted. I didn't have the label. I was being judged for the kind of pitcher that I was at that point for that team. And that's what I always wanted. And when it time came, I didn't see it. I didn't recognize it, at least at first. Then it dawned on me. This is what you asked for. What are you going to do about it?
Take a no-hitter into the ninth inning this afternoon at Yankee Stadium before a crowd of better than 27,000. One of the fans here on this overcast day on every pitch now.
Time was moving very slow. It didn't speed up. It was strange. It didn't speed up. It slowed down. Knees maybe felt a little bit not so stable, but excited, thrilled, you know, just electrified.
I remember glancing out at the field and looking how alert and on their toes every player was. It was all about, I'm going to be here for Jim.
I can't remember how he caught wind of the game, but I remember listening to the game in the car in the driveway because it wasn't on television, and so we were getting updated like through the radio.
Fans are standing. I've never noticed that.
Everyone in the stadium on their feet, screaming and yelling. You know, players' hearts beating out of their chests. And Kenny Lofton, one of the best players in the American League, comes up.
The 1-2, and a bouncer over the head of Abbott to Gallego, one out in the ninth.
It's a good thing you didn't get it.
You're right, or knocked it away, yeah. Or do anything.
Here we go.
Here's Felix for Maine.
Stadium's alive. This is actually going to happen, maybe. And if you spend any time in a ballpark at all, you know that home runs sound differently than other hits. Came off the bat and it sounded like a home run. And against the clatter of the crowd, against all the hearts beating, here's his ball soaring to left center field.
Fly ball, left center field, long run, Bernie Williams, he's there! Two outs in the ninth as Bernie Williams tracked it down into left center field.
Your heart must have skipped a beat.
Yeah.
When he hit that.
At that point, it's like, God, they've made so many great plays today. You know somebody's going to be there. Come on.
With this catch, the fans are on their feet. Jim Abbott has a no-hitter. Two outs into the ninth, and he'll have to face Carlos Baerga.
I was saying to my mind, you need to do it. Don't try to pull it. Try to go over shortstop, you know, to stay with the pitch. I want to get it. I want to get the base hit. I don't want to, nobody go to hit saying, not going to give up.
watching Jim Abbott now crawl within one out of pitching a no-hitter. And I do remember taking a moment to think about the magnitude of this situation. Here was Jim Abbott, born without a right hand, pitching at Yankee Stadium against a tremendous Cleveland lineup.
When you want to know the score, it's on.
And now he's within one out of immortality.
Touchdown, Arkansas!
And the Indians have not had a man pass first base.
There's times when you're so happy you can barely catch your breath. And that's how I felt. It really happened in Yankee Stadium. Can you believe this? Can you believe it? That's cool. The fans were just, they wouldn't leave. You know, they just stayed and clapped.
Want this to happen to a guy like Jim.
How about that, baby? I think that's what I said.
How about that?
I tried to do everything I can to get that base hit, but you know what? He got the no-hitter.
He defied the laws of Major League Baseball. And that's a sign of a true champion.
He'd always have that. That there would always be that day on a field in Yankee Stadium where there was nobody better at baseball than Jim Abbott.
It still makes me tearful. The happiness of the moment can't be matched. It was wonderful.
Sometimes things happen that nobody sees coming, and that's the beauty of sport. This was a day when baseball and life repaid Jim for everything he had meant and the impact he had made on so many human beings.
We need moments that we can seize upon, right? Sometimes it's too hard for people to absorb the whole story. But that moment still resonates.
It resonates in so many ways. But I think it stands as something that kids maybe who were born like me or who face some other challenge that you can't even see can look to and say, hey, the world doesn't have to dictate how this script is going to go. I hope that it was a bedtime story for a parent out there with a young kid who may see the challenges of his life as insurmountable.
So this is where we normally keep it, so that the kids can look at it, or from time to time I do too. Thank you for your letter on April 12th. It's always nice to hear from fans such as yourself, but especially someone so far away. I also appreciate the pictures you passed along. You look like a very happy young lady with many great things ahead. I understand your feelings regarding your left hand, but that should never stop you from accomplishing those things in life you want. Work hard at whatever you choose to do. Finish school and believe in yourself. If you continue to do these things, then maybe one day I'll read about your accomplishments. Sincerely, Jim Abbott.
Truthfully, like, I look at the picture of myself and I feel like her inside still. In his small act of charity, of his small act of kindness, he allowed an 8-year-old girl to feel, okay, I'm okay in my skin. Okay. So I think that there's profound outreach in what he did. I don't think he probably understands the difference he's made. My grandparents would watch us at school before we go to school in the morning, and I was, I think, in grade 2 or grade 3, and my grandfather and my dad were both avid baseball watchers, and Jim Abbott hit the circuit of baseball. At that age, I didn't know anything, and my grandfather had cut out a picture of him and his story and he taped it to their kitchen. To their kitchen wall, and he said, look, Trace, he's just like you, and look at all that he's doing. It was just, I didn't know this person, like, he's a complete stranger. I still don't know who he is, like, in that regard, but there was something so pivotal and so instrumental in who he was and what he was able to accomplish and all the stigma that he was able to break. I've been blessed to be married to my husband, Shane, since 2007. We have 4 beautiful children. I went to teacher's college. I got a job full-time right out of university in 2005, and I've been teaching for the school board here in the city of Windsor since that time. Gorgeous. Jim Abbott changed my perspective on how I viewed obstacles. I always felt like I had a cheerleader. I know that's kind of silly, but I felt like it was like, okay, this guy did it and he's encouraging and he sees that I'm just as capable as he is. And for me, it was life-changing. He allowed his light to permeate, and that light in turn lit all these little children's lights all over the world. So you have this boom of brightness that's happening, and that's uncontrollable. That's beautiful.
To Jim Abbott, if we show him this, after you watched him all those years when you were a kid. Thank you.
I wish a 12 lane would be quiet.
When I say the name Jim Abbott, what does that mean to you?
It means that anybody can do anything, whether or not one hand, one leg, or nothing at all. Anybody can do anything, no matter how different you are.
What you do, what you can do, with what you
you got.
He's the symbol. He's the guy you want to be.
I idolized him growing up. I still do.
Do what you can do with what you got.
My first baseball game was the Jim Abbott no-hitter when I was 3 years old. Funny enough, like 30 years later, here we are, and I have a daughter with a limb difference, and Jim is just a big like icon in this world.
He was at an ice cream shop, and I got the chance to meet him, and he actually taught me how to tie my shoes, and I needed to know how to tie my shoes the day before kindergarten, and I got it. I figured it out 3 days after I met him, and I was able to take the test when I got to school.
We were able to coordinate a meetup with him at Comiskey Park when they played the White Sox. Every time I would hit a barrier, I'm like, man, Jim's already broken this barrier. Like, this isn't going to be a problem. We'll figure it out.
In high school, I threw a complete game, and I get in the car to drive home, and I've got a voicemail from a California number. I'm like, who from California would be calling me?
This is Jim Abbott calling. I wanted to call and say congratulations. Just rooting for you. I wanted you to know that.
Do what you can do with what you got.
He's out there throwing no-hitters against the best baseball players in the world. So why can't I wrestle? Why can't I fight? Why can't I do this?
I feel like I have a really big responsibility of carrying on the legacy that Jim Abbott created. It almost feels like that's my job.
Hey, you set that example. He made something that seemed impossible possible. And I feel like Jim Abbott was the foundation
because he inspired me to go do the unbelievable and make it believable.
Struggle. I know the journey. I know it's not easy. And I'm just so proud to be a part of this community. I'm proud to have played a small part in your lives. It means the world to me. It is how I'd like to be remembered.
Really was
like something out of fiction. I wanted everything in the film to reflect this legend of Bo, this superhero kind of idea, and the film to be about the mythology surrounding Bo Jackson. In some ways, it's a deconstruction of how myths and heroes are created and what they mean to us in our lives and why they're important.
And there are superstars, and then there was Bo Jackson.
Like, I'm like, I'm fast. He's faster. Then there's Bo Jackson.
Bo Jackson was as good an athlete as the country has seen probably since Jim Schultz.
It's me, the greatest athlete.
He's
open,
complete at the 10. Touchdown, Arkansas!
Every two or three days, he would do something to make you just kind of scratch your head and say, man, I don't know if I saw that right, you know.
Jackson makes a great catch.
Bo Jackson was the first superhero of my generation.
There's something mythical about everything that he did.
There goes Bo, and nobody catches Bo.
He may not stop yet. Tacoma.
He was like a rocket ship that was fired out of a cannon.
He was excitement incarnate.
He was untouchable.
Bo was just better than everybody else.
All we saw was a man doing things that we had no idea were humanly possible. Then out of nowhere, he was gone.
Jackson was one of the last, well, how can I describe this? He was one of the last athletes who the information about him was anecdotal, that you wouldn't necessarily see the things you heard about them, but there was kind of like this legendary, kind of like Paul Bunyan description around him.
From the time he was a little kid, he was almost like a Paul Bunyan type of figure. He was this larger-than-life ideal.
And the stories about Bo Jackson were always very vivid because not only were they amazing, they were often very weird.
I saw him, myself, jump over a Volkswagen. I saw it.
One day, Bo's by himself just standing in the water, just standing there up to about his thighs. And all of a sudden, he just jumps out of the water and does a backflip. And my girlfriend said, "Did you see that?" I said, "Yeah, I saw that."
I remember hearing a story that, you know, when he was in eighth grade, he dunked a stick. That he had, like, found a stick, and he was on an outdoor basketball court as an eighth grader, and he dunked this stick or whatever. It was a strange story. It was so strange that, like, it seemed real, because why would someone make up the idea that he was dunking a stick? Yeah.
One person would have seen the thing, and then the next person absolutely didn't see it, but he heard a person talk about having seen it. So he can say that he saw it, and then you tell the next guy, well, did you see it? Yeah, I saw it.
You have the story of him, throwing rocks at the minister's pig and killing the minister's pig.
It's kind of a weird story that he got nicknamed Bo because he killed boars. That's right. He got in trouble for killing a bunch of boars.
I remember vaguely hearing about boar, the boar hog type stories, but I really don't know anything about that.
That would seem like it would be a less popular story in this day and age, probably, that people would be less excited about a guy whose, like, first claim to fame was killing a bunch of pigs.
And then running away, leaping over a 40-foot ditch to get away, which, you know, no kid can actually leap over a 40-foot ditch, but it's a hell of a story.
I don't know if it's true or not, but I was told it was true.
I remember hearing that, you know, Auburn is playing in the Sugar Bowl. And then during the pregame warm-ups, he takes a football and he throws up and he hits the scoreboard, which previously only punters had done.
He went and picked the ball up and threw it up there.
The things he did were so incredible and so unbelievable that people want to talk about them. People want to keep that stuff alive.
There was always the idea that potentially he could do something that would be completely unbelievable. And he didn't even have to necessarily do these things for people to assume that they were true.
Anything that you hear about Bo Jackson, I would probably tell you 99% of it is true.
And he's fun to think about. He's fun to remember.
And I think he enjoyed elevating that myth. He enjoyed playing around with it a little bit. I think he still enjoys playing around with it a little bit. I think all of that is part of who he is.
I grew up in a small town outside of Birmingham, Alabama, called Bessemer. Bessemer, Alabama. Small town, very low-income area. My mother raised 10 kids in a three-room house that probably wasn't 700 square feet. We moved when I was in the first grade to a house that I thought was a castle from where we moved to. And till this day, that's still home for me when I go home. It was kind of hard for me as a kid to interact with a lot of people because, number one, I always felt that I didn't belong because I was one of those kids that just had my mom at home. And most of my other friends had their mom and dad home. I inherited stuttering from my father, which made me introverted, which means I didn't talk a lot. I didn't conversate a lot with people. And when somebody was having a conversation, I just stood in the back and didn't say anything. And then when I did say something, other kids would laugh and make fun of me, which took that shy, quiet person and made him very angry. The way I vented that anger is by fighting. I fought a lot. I was known throughout my neighborhood for throwing rocks. We would have crabapple battles, and I would always end up winning because they get tired of throwing, and I was just getting started. I've broken windows. I've thrown apples through screen doors because they got tired and ran inside the house and thought they were safe. And an apple would come through the screen door. Back when I got to college and got to the professional level, people were amazed at what arm strength I had. And I'm like, I've been doing this since I was 8, 9 years old.
I went to interview for McCurry High School baseball coach. Had an opening. And as I walked up for the interview, I looked down at the football field and there, the gentleman, the shirt off, the shovel on his shoulder. And I thought, man, that maintenance guy is a big old man. So I interviewed with the principal, and after the interview, she said, Terry, I think you've got the job. And I said, well, can I ask you a question? I'm just curious about y'all's maintenance guy down there. Is he a bodybuilder? She said, what maintenance guy? She looked down and said, oh, no, that's Bo Jackson. He's on a summer program here. I said, he play ball? She said, oh, yeah, he plays ball. So I went, yes. That's when I first saw Bo.
He just has so many skills and special talents that most kids just don't have. He played offense, played defense. He kicked off, he punted. He returned kickoffs and he returned punts and he kicked extra points field goals. And it was just all natural ability, just God-given.
He played football, baseball, and track. And track was his first love.
He was just phenomenal. He set a state record in the triple jump his senior year. He high jumped 6'8", set a new state record. And we had to borrow a pole because we didn't even have a track at McAdoo. It's a 180-pound test pole, which is for 180-pounders and down. And Bo was 215 using that pole and went over 13 feet. I mean, we saw him do some things that were just, you don't see happen in high school.
That was the beginning of the era of specialization, or even high school kids who were good athletes suddenly felt this pressure that, you know, if you wanted to be great, you had to choose. And that the world was becoming more competitive and more specialized, and you had to make this choice. You had to be one kind of person. And he did not seem interested in being one kind of person.
The stats started coming out about the start of the season. We'd have 3 or 4 at practice, then 4 or 5 at the game, and it just started growing. The Yankees sent down their super scout, Steinbrenner's number one scout. He said, Coach, can I see Bo? Can I see him hit? I said, no, practice is over. He said, Coach, Steinbrenner sent me in here personally to see this kid. Please let me just see him hit or throw or something. I said, I told y'all, I'm not going to do that. And Bo just happened to hear me. He said, Coach, I'll hit a couple of balls in the cage. And I said, all right. So the scout gets behind the cage where Bo is, and inside the cage, and I'm throwing. I said, you got two pitches. So I threw the first one. He hits a rocket, line driving into the far corner of the cage. And the cage starts moving. The whole cage is bouncing. All of a sudden, the cage collapsed on me and Bo. And the scout says, Coach, I've seen enough. He got in his car and drove off.
George Steinbrenner wanted to draft me. He wanted me to come up right out of high school, jump in the lineup with the Yankees. And he was going to give me a signing bonus. And he said he was going to start at $250,000 and go up until I signed. And with me growing up poor, I didn't know what $250,000 looked like.
And he turned it down. And his mother was quoted as saying, says, you know, what do I need George Steinbrenner's money for? We've gotten along fine without him.
Oh, George Steinbrenner was a little ticked.
But that's who the Jacksons were. And Bo was very close to his mother. And, you know, the Jacksons were, you know, they were poor, but they were fiercely proud.
Bo promised her that he would be the one that would go to college because none of the others did.
The day Bear Bryant called my house, it was like God calling. And the neighbors wanted to come up. Bear Bryant called you on that phone right there. Yep, called me on that phone. So people would, literally neighbors would come over and look at the phone. And then he said, I'm going to send one of my coaches up to visit you, sit down and talk to him. Wow. It was during baseball season. I walk in the front door. There was a white man sitting at the table with my mother having coffee. He said, Bo, I know that you don't want to leave the state. And we know the only other school you're interested in talking to is Auburn. He said, let me tell you something, young man. He said, Auburn hasn't beat Alabama since 1972, 10 years, and they never will. He said, Bo, we want you, but I don't think you'll get a chance to play until the end of your sophomore year or the beginning of your junior year. That's all was said. And then the following week, same scenario. Coach drops me off in the front of the house. I walk in the door. There's two white guys sitting at the table talking to my mom. I'm like, oh, here we go again. Gentleman comes downstairs. He called me Vincent. He said, Vincent? I said, yes, sir. He said, my name's Pat Dye. He said, I'm the head coach at Auburn University. If you come to Auburn, he said, I promise you, I will give you every opportunity to play and start as a freshman. I looked him right in his eye and I said, Coach Dye, you will see me at Auburn.
The fans remember Bo a lot more than they remember me. Because I didn't score a touchdown. But I can see him taking it against Florida right now, 80 yards in a close ball game. And some of the most phenomenal things that he did with his body, he never even thought about it. And I'd sit there and look at him and I said, I can't believe I saw what I just saw. And it was an everyday thing to him. He lived with it 24 hours a day and I just saw it 2 hours a day. And but he's something. He was a difference maker. Bo set the standards.
Third down, six to the Auburn 24. Pat's going to leave it with Bo. And he's going to break a tackle. And he's going to break another tackle. 35-40. Down the sideline. We got a foot race at the 40, the 30, the 20. Bye-bye, Bo! Touchdown, Auburn!
He really emerged as a star at Auburn. He was spellbinding. We'll be right back. there was something larger than life.
The first time I ever saw Bo Jackson was in college up close and personal when my University of Maryland Terrapins visited Auburn. And I'll never forget the first time walking out on Jordan-Hare Stadium, and there was Bo Jackson. And I looked at him, I said, we're going to be in trouble.
Football career at Auburn, there seemed to be this initial perception that he's sort of the new Herschel Walker because he was playing in the SEC and he was this combination of size and speed. Then he turned out to be a better version of Walker in a lot of ways because it was all natural. He was just showing up and doing this.
Can't coach it. That's the it thing that everybody talks about.
College baseball was in its infancy in terms of popularity. But in this part of the world, we never went anywhere that it wasn't packed. But it was because of Bo. And we'd have visiting coaches call and ask if we could come early so Bo could sign autographs for an hour. These are things we're going to play. Because of the scoreboard and the Green Monster here, you lose some perspective. But between the Green Monster and the scoreboard, you can see a building between there. And you can't tell, but it's about 115 feet. He short hopped that from home plate. So you're looking at 385 plus another 100 plus feet. There was a parking lot in between the fence and the dorm, and he hit one under that parking lot too. That light tower there in right center field, which has not been moved, he hit one up there against Ole Miss. So, I mean, and they're as vivid as they happened to me yesterday. I mean, I haven't forgotten any of those. Pretty impressive. When Coach Dye hired me, he said, oh, by the way, you'll be coaching the greatest athlete that's ever lived. I went, oh, sure, I know he's great, but come on. As time went on, I came to believe that to be absolutely the truth. He did something every day that you had not seen before, and a package of skills that had never existed in any one individual. I never coached another player like I coached Bud. I never told him to do anything. But I would suggest things to him. And if there was something that I thought had a chance to really make him better, I would go to him and just very subtly say, Bo, this is a really hard thing to do, and I doubt you can do it. But a lot of great big league players have done this. You don't even have to try it if you want to, because I doubt you can get it. But you might want to try it. Well, in 2 days, he'd have it.
He had great hand-eye coordination, and he was highly intelligent. You could diagram a new play, put it on the board. He might run it twice, and he'd have it down.
You know, the old saying is when you have a play like that, just get him in uniform and get him to the park on time. That was pretty much what we did.
I'd have to be honest with you. Practice, to me, I felt was a waste of time.
He was not the kind of athlete that you want to take out there and wear him out on practice field.
There were times when me and the running back coach would bump heads because I'm like, all this excessive running is unnecessary. Bud Casey is probably the most vocal coach on the planet. Run back to the hole. Come on, do it. Get back in the hole. Come on, blood. And his famous line was blood on the saddle. That means that you're tough. That means that you can withstand anything. You can endure anything. But I'm not going to have a heat stroke trying to please you, because I'll be the one in the hospital, or I'll be the one dead, and you'll still be running up and down the field talking about blood on the saddle.
The Auburn-Alabama rivalry is like having Christmas with in-laws with whom you don't get along very well.
Hadn't beat Alabama in, I think, 8 years when I got to Auburn in 1981, and we lost in 81. So it was 9 years, I guess, without beating Alabama.
Alabama leading by 5 points, but Auburn is knocking on the door.
The fact that Alabama had won 9 years in a row began to have an effect on Auburn people's psyche. We were beaten mentally and emotionally.
Well, the Alabama side is holding its breath. The Auburn side is roaring lustily here at Legion Field.
You know, it's a game that if you win it, you got 365 days of happiness and joy, and if you lose it, you have to live with it for that long.
Fourth down, goal to go, a half a yard.
The Alabama games, those were some of the most memorable moments. My freshman year, that bowl over the top. I said, Coach, I was a 7-foot high jumper in high school. Why don't we go over the top?
Well, my goodness. Fourth and goal and a half a yard. Jackson over the top. Touchdown.
Perhaps a writer from the Birmingham News named Jimmy Bryan said it best. Games like these come along only once in a long while. A team and its coach prove themselves great on the inside, where the heart is. The public watches, understands, and is proud. When Bo went over the top, that was probably the single biggest play in Auburn football history. That day, Bo Jackson gave Auburn the greatest thing an individual can give a people or a school. He gave Auburn hope.
It's my really great privilege to present the 51st Heisman Memorial Trophy to Bo Jackson of Auburn.
Bo was this fatherless kid who sort of had a chip on his shoulder, was known as a bully in the neighborhood, and then channeled all that anger into sports. And even before he had left college, he was already this myth in people's mind.
Why do we need heroes? Why do we look up to people like Bo Jackson? Because we're less than perfect, and we're always looking for perfection. Somebody who can do it better than we can. Somebody who can be an example to us of what we can do, what we can be. That's why Bo is important, because he offers us the hope and the example of being something more than we alone think we might be.
Today, we're...
Evan Canty and Michelle are unsportsmanlike.
I think if you're the Miami Dolphins, you cut ties with him. He's not your future at the quarterback position, and quite frankly, you can't move your team forward with him being out there. You understand you're on the hook for his salary next year? Pay it. It's okay. The last thing you want to do is be tied to him beyond next year. Russell Wilson, Denver Broncos style. Get rid of him. Be done with it.
Unsportsmanlike. Weekday morning starting at 6 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN2. This is Freddie and Harry.
That's why I call him a king mixer. All of a sudden, man, you know, hope you guys can deal with the pressure and all this stuff. I wasn't trying to be trolling. I wasn't being backhand complimentary. You exactly were doing that because you know if our Knicks get to the NBA Finals, and let's say they do it, they expect the Atlanta Hawks, you might want to take June off, Harry Douglas. It's going to be hell for you.
Check out more from Freddie and Harry weekdays at 3 Eastern on ESPN Radio and the ESPN app. Evan Canty and Michelle are unsportsmanlike.
With Seattle, the only question around the quarterback is not with his physical ability, but it's with his ability to avoid those self-inflicting wounds if, in fact, things don't go his way for the majority of the game. This is a group that has something special. The quarterback is a big part of that. I believe the Seattle Seahawks can represent the NFC, bar none, hands down.
Unsportsmanlike. Weekday morning starting at 6 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN2.
After he won the Heisman, we had a little ceremony at McAdory High School for him. This was before he signed, did anything. And Coach Brazil and I, actually, after it was over, we walked him out to his car and said, "What are you going to do?"
I expected to play football at the professional level. And I had taken a few trips to visit some teams my senior years during baseball season. And I thought I had the okay to go to get on a plane that Hugh Culverhouse, the owner of the Buccaneers, sent up. So I got on the jet, went to Tampa Bay for my visit. About 4 or 5 days later, I'm back at Auburn getting ready for my baseball game. And I'm in my senior year, I'm tearing the cover off the ball. I'm batting over 400. Oh, I don't know how many home runs I was sitting on then, but I was hot as a bottle rocket in July. And I walked out on the field. Coach Baird approaches me. He said, "Bo, can I talk to you for a second?" I said, "Sure, Coach." He said, did you take a trip last week on Hugh Culverhouse's jet to go down to visit Tampa?" I said, "Yes," and the folks checked and said that it was okay. They checked with the NCAA and said that it was okay to do that. He said, "Well, Bo, somebody didn't check, and the NCAA has declared you ineligible for any more college sports, so you can't play baseball no more." And I sit there on that ground and I cried like a baby.
And it crushed Bo. And it crushed all of us because it was as innocent a thing as could be. And it cost him the second half of his senior year in baseball. And at that time, we all thought it probably cost him first round status in the baseball draft.
I was thinking about not going to Tampa Bay. Because the officials at Tampa Bay told me personally, "Yes, we checked and they said that it was okay." I think it was all a plot now just to get me ineligible from baseball because they saw the season that I was having and they thought that they were